Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, Gary.
Hello, Guy. How are you?
Well, I'm all right. Well, I just tested positive. Have we not mentioned that?
Well, you are positive.
You've
always been a positive person, though, I've found.
I'm a great believer in the power of positive thought and diagnoses.
But anyway, luckily, Mike Campbell, our guest today, is not sitting next to you.
He's a long way away, so I don't need to wear a mask.
He's probably talking from Los Angeles or somewhere.
I expect so. And what an amazing, amazing list of stuff this guy has done.
Yeah. Well, obviously, Tom Petty and all of, he's been Tom Petty's right-hand man, not just with the Heartbreakers, but all his solo stuff.
All the solo stuff, yeah, it's really sweet. It's one of those things where Tom couldn't move without him. He tried a couple of times, but he's like that old sofa that you just can't put in the attic.
And he co-wrote a lot of the big hits like Refugee, but also he co-wrote one of my favourite all-time songs. I think it's yours too, right?
It is. It's one of my favourite all-time songs. Also one of the great early 80s videos as well.
Yeah, Don Henley's Boys of Summer. He co-wrote that song, which I'm sure we'll be asking about. He's co-written songs with Stevie Nicks and played with Stevie Nicks, produced Stevie Nicks. What else has he done? Other artists. Think Jeff Lynne he's worked with. I mean,
lots with Jeff Lynne, lots with
Roy Orbison.
Yeah, no, he produced four songs on Roy Orbison's track. And then, of course, there's the Dirty Knobs, his other band. Yeah. And they've just done an album with Ian Hunter on it.
I know. There's so much to talk about.
Yeah, he's clearly such an Anglophile as well.
Well, that's right.
So hopefully he'll be nice to us.
So much to talk about, including your positivity, I would have thought. Welcome to the Rock on Tours.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
This was great, guys. It's so great to talk to two guys that have done this.
Well, it's a big tune, for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
You know, what people forget about Bowie is that he was such a kind man.
I've listened to a few of them, and they've been really good, man. I'm sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
I know you're musicians, but you've been more professional than a lot of journalists.
Remember me? I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
You get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rock on Tours podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Yay, Mike!
Hey, there you are. I see you now. How are you? Good morning.
Good morning. I presume that's Los Angeles if you're saying good morning.
Yes, it is. Who am I speaking to?
You're speaking to Guy Pratt. I'm a musician, and Gary Kemp, who's another musician.
Okay.
Why are you, Mike?
I'm good. How are you?
I guess you're doing a string of interviews, are you, at the moment?
I am. I'm doing one with you right now.
You must be rehearsing. You go on the road in a week, don't you?
We have two more days rehearsal, and then we're off. Can't wait.
No, the album sounds fantastic. Guy and
Brilliant.
I were both freaking out that one of our old childhood heroes, Ian Hunter, is on the record.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much. It was a thrill to get him.
Is that someone that you know, Mike? Do you have a long-running thing with him?
No, I don't. I might have met him a long time ago for a split second, but no, I got a call to the office that he wanted some guitar overdubs on a record he was doing. And he sent me the track, and I overdubbed, sent it back. I did two of them, and he really liked them, so I cheekily asked him if he would sing on our record, and he said sure. So on A Dirty Job, he the second verse and some harmonies and play some piano. It was a thrill. He did a great job.
I never know if he's going to do that American accent of his or just do the old Cockney all the young dudes vibe.
It was Cockney. I heard was very Cockney, but really good.
We've been trying to get Ian on the show, but I know he's in his 80s now, isn't he?
I don't know. He's got to be older than me, which just says a lot.
Yeah. And so how did all this come together with the Dirty Knobs? I know you had an album out like 2 years ago now, but was this something that really happened after Tom died?
No, it started happening about a decade before Tom died. I met the guys, and it became a project I would do in between tours when I was home. And it was a chance for me to write songs. And we played some bars and recorded a little bit. Always just been for fun, really. In the back of my mind, I always thought maybe someday I could concentrate on that band, because I love the band. And now I have the time, so it's all knobs all the time.
I mean, it's looking back on your CV, you certainly keep yourself so busy. It's like you can't stand still. The amount of collaborations you do is insane.
Well, when you love music as much as I do, you just want to keep doing it, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And I guess people love you too, so they're coming to you a lot of the time. I mean, your phone's ringing and asking you to do solos or whatever it might be. And what about the singing? Is that something that you always you wanted to do, and that you know, that wasn't allowed for you in the Heartbreakers?
Well, it wasn't that it wasn't allowed. I didn't have the confidence to want to do it with the Heartbreakers, because I had such a great leader in Tom. And I was really comfortable in my role as quote unquote co-captain in the Heartbreakers. And it never occurred to me to sing, because he was so good. But then as the years went on, I kept making up demos. You know, he had more than he could deal with. So I started singing them myself and writing my own words just to amuse myself and see what they might sound like. And I found that I enjoyed it quite a bit. And then when I got the knobs together, I was able to go out and front that band and do some singing, if you want to call it that. And
you can call it that.
Yeah, I got my confidence doing it that way. So it was a slow process, but I never had this big ambition to be a singer. But I kind of backed into it. You know, I think of myself more as a stylist, as Roy Orbison would say. He told me once about the Wilburys. They were in the other room. He goes, "Those guys, they're not really singers. I'm a singer. They're stylists." God bless. And he was right, you know. And I love getting inside the personality of the character in the song. I'm no Caruso, but I can get the point across.
Yeah, no, I think that was what's obvious when you listen to the album. They're American stories, aren't they, of working class life?
Yeah, they're stories, and they're characters that just some of them, some reality creeps through, but they're mostly just been fictional characters in this little movie called A Song. And I love fleshing them out, you know, starting out with a germ and then seeing what's going to happen to them by the end of the movie.
And can you see anything that inspired you from that you learnt from Tom and his writing style? Is there stuff that you feel you picked up?
Yeah, I'm sure I picked up quite a bit from just rubbing shoulders with him all those years. You know, I taught him some guitar and he taught me some writing skills. But yeah, I mean, he's a great writer. You know, he's really good with lyrics, and watching him put his songs together and craft the verses and choruses, you know, I picked up a lot of those tools along the way.
Yeah, also because Tom basically didn't move without you, did he, for so long? Even when he would sort of go off to do a solo thing, you'd always be there with him.
Yeah, we had a bond, you know, and we trusted each other. And I think that he respected me enough to want me there, even when it was a solo record. And I always appreciated that with him. And it was just a thing we had together that's, you know, magic happened when we played together or wrote together.
Yeah, talking about producing, though, that this album, you've got George Drakoulis. Now, I'm interested in George because
he comes up a lot.
He comes up a lot. And I watched the Wildflowers making of documentary, which is beautiful. I especially love all the stuff with you and Rick chatting, but Rick Rubin. Yeah. But George is there. And I texted Guy, who I know was watching it. I said, I think he might be their magic Alex.
He is. It's funny. When I first met George, he and Rick had come out from New York. They had that Def Jam label or whatever. And they came to L.A. Tom and I went over to visit Rick at his house one day. And George was living in a closet at the house, literally a closet. He had a guitar amplifier and a pillow. And I thought, this is a guy, you know, cut from my cloth. And then we hang around with him. And George is just one of those special people that puts people at ease and makes the proceedings fun. But he's also really smart with picking songs and arranging the performance and getting the best out of everybody. He's a joy to work with.
Because like on that album, he didn't actually have any title or anything, did he? It's like he said, he just kept turning up.
Yeah, he just kept showing up. I guess.
But what is it? Go ahead, just explain what it is that you need George in the room. Is he a musician?
Not much of me.
He plays the ocarina.
But he's essential to my process. I'll tell you why. Because I do write a lot. I don't really always write in one particular genre. I just write all kinds of songs, you know. And I had a bunch of different types of songs. And he came in and he helped me weed through the stuff that wasn't right for the Dirty Knobs and pare it down. Well, these are really good for the band. These other songs, maybe you could do in a different format someday or with a different group. But he helped me kind of pick the right songs that went together as a package for the band. And it was really helpful because I was a little overwhelmed. You know, I think when people produce themselves, you can disappear up your you-know-what if you don't have someone there to kind of get, say yes or no here and there, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I don't want to jump around too much, but because you're talking about like writing and producing yourself, I was amazed to discover that because you co-wrote one of Gary and my absolute favorite songs of all time, Boys of Summer, but that you... But you had Roger Lynn in the back room or something, and you like were working on like the first Lynn drum, which it seems really odd seeing you at the absolute forefront of kind of electronic music making. It's like you suddenly become Kraftwerk,
which I've gone past now. But it's an interesting story because he was a guitar player who played with Leon Russell, and back in the early days we were hanging around at Leon Russell's house occasionally. And Roger was always in the back room, like a mad scientist. And we say, what's he doing back there? And Leon said, oh, he's building a drum machine. And we thought, why? That's a waste of time. But sure enough, he came up with this brilliant tool called the Lynn drum. And I got one of the first ones and was diddling around on it. You know, you could make your own drum beats by typing your fingers.
Oh, it was a nightmare. It took forever.
I used that to write The Boys of Summer. I got a beat on there and then played some stuff along with that. And it led me into that song. Yeah.
Oh, come on. You can't just cut it short like that, Mike. I mean, how did that develop? Now we're in that talking about Boys of Summer and Don Henley. And how did it develop? Did you have all of the chord structure?
Yeah, it's definitely
out.
Worth lighting a pipe for. Definitely worth lighting a pipe for. Loving the pipe.
Oh, it's tobacco. It's tobacco. It's not
okay.
But it's my last vice. I've given up all the other stuff. Yeah. Well, I'll tell you quickly. It's a songwriting experience that I had. I had the Lynn drum, and I was basically playing around with it. And I got all those little tick, 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 you know, little bits. And And I was making a beat. And then I happened to have a synthesizer there in my room that day. I had the beat. I was just going da-da-da-da-da along with that and came up with the chords on the keyboard. And under my TAC 4-track, you know, I put the drums on one track and the keyboard on another and put a few guitars on it and threw the chords together like I always do when I write. You know, I just kind of put something together that I thought, you know, had a feel and an arc to it. And I was just really lucky with that one. You know, Don heard it and immediately, you know, got a song in his head.
Did you write it for Tom initially? Did you think it was
for
him?
Well, everything I write is basically for me. But of course, with Tom, I would always show him everything I did. And I showed him that song, him and Jimmy Iovine, during whatever record we were working on, Southern Accents. And I had the demo and I played it for him. And they kind of liked it. But in Tom's defense, at the time I played it for him, I had a different chorus chord. I went to a minor chord in the chorus. Mm. And as the summer was finished, it goes to a major chord in the chorus, which lifts it up.
That would have been Boys of Winter.
Yes, he didn't really hear it the way Don heard it.
Yeah.
Or he may have kept it. But it really wasn't in the flow of the thing we were doing at the time. And so Iovine told me that Don was looking for some music. I figured, well, that's been overlooked. I'll send this to him. And, you know, I'm just, I'm always seem to be in the right place at the right time, you know. I don't know how.
But I was watching you talk about it on your Instagram site. And you were in the room, weren't you, when you played it to Don?
Yeah. I'd never met him before. And
oh, wow. So it's not like you knew him or something?
No. Jimmy Iovine on call. And I went to his house in L.A., up in the mountains, and he had this big breakfast table. He sat at one end like this with his arms crossed and his head down, and he had a little cassette player, and I gave him my cassette, and he didn't move. He didn't tap his foot. He didn't nod his head or anything. I thought he hated it. I'm sitting at the other end of the table just thinking, well, as soon as this is over, I'll get out of here, you know?
Wow. It sounds like a meeting between Macron and Putin, doesn't it, really?
Yeah. I don't know which is which.
Macron. Go for Macron.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry, Don. he kind of went, yeah, that's, you know, I'll work on that. And I thought, yeah, right. Okay. So I drove home. And then he called me and he said, I've written the best song I've written in 10 years to that track, and I want to make a record out of it. And I guess he took the cassette out in his car and he saw a Deadhead sticker on a Cadillac and he wrote the words listening to the cassette. And yeah, there's more to the story, but that's the rough idea how it happened.
You know what? I think, you know, we all love what Don added to that and lyrically what he added to it. But the music that you gave him, I think, you know, as a songwriter myself, it led him into the wistful nostalgia that the lyrics were about. I feel that was already, that's in the music. He just drew out what you were already making.
You're right. You're right. There's a, and it's, you know, I'm not going to take full credit for it. It's just a muse, you know. It was a day where I just had those chords, struck a chord in me, and I put the guitar on, and it all seemed to take on this shape of a mood, you know, like a wistful mood. But then with the redemption in the chorus where it goes major key, which really made a difference. And I do think the music is really good on that one. It kind of stands on its own as an instrumental in a way. And I guess when Don heard it, he could feel that, and it inspired him, you know, to come up with what he came up with. So it's a give and take thing.
Is that like your original, that's your original Linn programming on it, isn't it? It's all the lots of hand claps. And
it's all on the Linn drum, yeah.
Yeah, because the whole thing, especially then with that really super high-end video and everything, it was a real template for kind of 80s music.
Well, I don't know about that, but I know it sounds great on the radio. When I hear it, I'm real proud of it.
Yeah.
Is it the biggest song you ever wrote, Mike?
No, I don't know. What do you mean by biggest?
The most played, I would have thought. You know,
financially? That's one of them. It's right up there. I mean, Refugee, Running Down a Dream, Here Comes My Girl, Woman in Love. Yeah. You Got Lucky. I mean, I've got a lot of songs that still get played and that I'm really proud of that I think were equally as good as Boys of Summer. But each song is like its own little entity. You know, it has its own little feel and mood, spirituality. But Boys of Summer is right up there, yeah.
We should go back to Gainsborough. Your inspirations as a start. Because what Guy and I were talking about earlier was the first time we remember seeing you guys would have been on Top of the Pops. We kind of saw you as a new wave band from America in the same sort of Elvis Costello feel.
You got in at the right time. You were totally seen as part of the new wave and you were, you know, loved by the British music press, which was, you know, tricky at that point.
Yeah, I was lucky for it.
And we found you first.
You did. Absolutely. I give you credit for that. And thank you very much.
What do you think that inspiration was?
You know, labels, you know, punk, new wave, whatever. At the time, the new wave phrase was going around. And we're a rock and roll band. You know, we're not really new wave. Yeah. But because we were around at that time, we kind of got lumped in with that group.
Well, it's because you were authentic. It's because you had an authentic, real thing and short songs.
Yeah. But stylistically, I mean, when I think of new wave, I think of keyboards and echo and reverb. And we're not that. We're like a Bo Diddley band.
I think one of the reasons that it feels like that is because there was obviously a connection. It's this kind of paradox, irony, really, that British music, 60s blues, beat blues, was really very, obviously came from America, but it had a very British sound. And you seem to be plugged into that British sound.
I would assume that you and Tom were both kind of Anglophiles musically, although there's a lot of the Birds in there as well, isn't there?
You know what? You hit on a very important point in my life and Tom's life. The era that we grew up in was so amazing. You know, it was, and I didn't know at the time that that was just a special little Renaissance moment. I thought that's the way it was always going to be. But things have changed a lot since the 60s. And Tom and I grew up in Florida, and there was a lot of blues bands. Mm-hmm. We didn't want to do that. We were influenced by the Beatles, the Animals, the Zombies, the Yardbirds, the Stones. We were turned on by that stuff, which was also a lot of it turned on by the old blues American. Mm-hmm. So it kind of came full circle. But we always resisted and weren't drawn into the American blues, Lynyrd Skynyrd type thing. We were more enamored with the British bands. In fact, I wish I could have lived in London in the 60s. I have a fantasy. I mean, there's two plays. There's like the California Dream was another thing. It was beautiful.
Yeah.
But then there was that English, you know, Kings Road.
Bag of Nails.
All those great bands. Great, great band. The Kinks. All those great guitar players. And so that's where I draw from. That's who I am. That's what inspired me. And maybe that comes out in the way I play. I don't know. It probably does. That's the stuff I love.
We had Shel Talmy on the show here a couple of months ago.
Ah, the producer, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, and you know, what he invented, that raw sound of the Kinks, you really got me.
So good. The drum sound and stuff he got on the Kinks and the Who. I think he did some stuff with the Who as well.
Yeah, he did the first few Who records. Which, actually, although Pete said that it's, although Glyn Johns, is worth bearing on, was his engineer.
I know so. Glyn, yeah. Right. He was part of it, yeah.
Yeah.
When you met Tom, was it one of those kind of, well, you write the songs, I've got the riffs, we're Mick and Keith, not even that really, because obviously Tom is a much more of a solo writer. Did you see yourself as two pieces that could easily fit together?
You know, we didn't really think about it. We just became friends. You know, we liked the same things and we liked playing together. We didn't put any kind of intellectual thought to it. We just kind of played together and worked together. He was writing, I was writing. And I think we respected each other. You know, it's funny you talk about the Stones, the Glimmer Twins.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's our drummer, Stan Lynch, used to call me and Tom the Dimmer Twins.
But actually, one thing I only just discovered from researching this, going back, all the early pictures of Tom, like in, you know, I don't know if about Mudcrutch, but certainly before then, he was playing bass.
That's right. He was a bass player when I met him. But he was writing songs on acoustic guitar. He was a writer, but a bass player, yeah.
But then he never picked one up again. Was he any good?
He's a great bass player. Right. He bass on the new Mudcrutch stuff. But when we got out to L.A. and started making a record, he was writing a lot of the songs. And I don't think he didn't even have an electric guitar. So I let him borrow my Strat. And he played that on the first two records and wrote his songs on that. And that was his vibe, you know. So he became a guitar player because he was writing. And then we got someone else to play the bass. But he's got a great feel on the bass. And he had a Hofner bass back in the day.
That's right. Yeah, I've seen pictures of that. Yeah. It's funny because I get the impression from all the stuff we've seen that you were kind of guitar heads. You like, you have a lot of guitars around.
Yeah, yeah. I was looking at Bugs's clubhouse. And I mean, man, how much would I love to spend some time with those in that room with all those amps and guitars?
It's inspiring, you know, but we started out with two or three guitars. That's all we had for the first 5 years. And then as we started making a little bit of money, we'd pass a guitar, we'd be like, oh, I got to have that. I always wanted that. Now I can afford it, you know, and it started to, it grew into an obsession over the years. Kind of got out of control, but.
Because I always kind of picture you when I think of my immediate thought, when I think of you two, is it's him with the Telecaster and you with the Rickenbacker.
Mm. Yeah, we weren't really locked into one thing. He played a Strat, my Strat, a lot. Then later on, he turned to a Tele. And, you know, we play whatever we needed, you know, whatever sound we needed to make at the time. You know, we weren't precious about it. Here, you play my guitar. I'll play yours on this song. You know,
I'm just interested in that moment, Mike, when you decide to go from, you're in a band called Mudcrutch, you know, which is, and I saw some photographs and they're quite glam rock looking at times. But to suddenly come out on that first album and say, do you know what? Tom's name's going first. We're not just the Heartbreakers. That's a massive leap. Do you remember that conversation?
I do. And it made perfect sense. It was Denny Cordell. Mudcrutch had fallen apart in the studio because we didn't know what the hell we were doing. And so they were going to keep Tom on as an artist on Shelter Records. And Tom wanted me. Tom insisted, well, I'll stay with you, but you got to keep Mike and Ben Mott, you know, in the fold. And so he was writing the songs and singing the songs. And it just, it made sense to be Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. That's what it was. You know, it wasn't like any put on. And I was very comfortable with it because he's a great leader. You know, he deserved to have his name up front.
Well, you can see that some of the business moves that happened later, some of the kind of brinksmanship he did with the record company. Also, it's a great name, Tom Petty. You know, it's
he's very savvy and very determined and would not let anybody tell him what to do in any record company or anybody. You know, he was very strong that way. And also with the music, you know, he was like, follow me. I know which way to go, you know.
Because it's extraordinary, because you bet you were this band and you had a deal and then it falls apart and then people are going off to try and do different things. And then you end up all based, essentially, most pretty much all of you coming back together as a band and then off it goes.
It's an American miracle.
When you say American miracle, I just thought it was quite funny from watching interviews and stuff how it was seemed to be two quite posh sounding English guys who had your manager and your record company.
Well, we were an English band because we carried ourselves that way. We, as the Heartbreakers started playing, we kind of, you know, we went to London early on and we got some clothes and some boots and we just kind of, people thought we had an English tour manager and he would introduce the band with the English accent. And everybody assumed that we were all English, you know.
And you had Denny Cordell producing you, who, you know, who'd produced the Moody Blues and the Move and was a real sort of 60s English producer.
Yeah. Procol Harum, Whiter Shade of Pale. Denny was really important for us. He was a great guru for Tom and the band, and he led us in the right direction. And kind of like George Drakoulias does with the Dirty Knobs, Denny Cordell was like showing us the right way to go, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Tom comes up with this song, American Girl, on that first album. The first album doesn't do very well in the States. The single doesn't do very well. It's still to this day seen as your biggest anthem, you know. Yeah. And I read just recently that it was the last song that you played on stage with Tom. It's an incredible story in that song alone, the journey of your band.
It is. There's something magical about that song, and I knew it the first time I heard it. I think that's when Tom really became a writer. You know, head and shoulders above other writers. That song is so well crafted, and the lyrics and the music and the character in that song, it holds up, you know, and I still love playing that song. Sometimes we do it with my band just because it's just an adrenaline rush. You know, there's something magical about it that is uplifting, you know, and hopeful and has redemption somehow. It feels like, you know, things are going to be okay. You know, it's uplifting.
Yeah. Is that guitar line yours, that ring? Because that's one of the all-time great sort of little riffs. The breakdown riff, which is just...
Well, breakdown, yeah. That I came up with all those things. He would come and the chord structure and the lyrics and the melody, and then we all start playing along, and I'd make up my stuff, and Ben would make up his, and it became a band sound, you know.
But it was nice, because as a lead player, you were very much, it sounds to me, very influenced by kind of early George Harrison. And that it's like, it's not an inch of fat. It's get in, do something that really, really adds something to the song and get out.
And that's the type of songs he was writing. You know, he wasn't writing the type that required guitar showmanship. And like I said before, the stuff I grew up on, the Kinks, the Beatles, the Stones, that's the way those guitar parts were. That's the way I thought guitars supposed to be. Now, when Jimi Hendrix came along, I loved that too. And I can do that. I can go in that direction. But the Heartbreakers songs, you know, didn't seem to lean that way. And so it was a marriage made in heaven for me and Tom, because we heard things the same way. You know?
There's a kind of sound of music that isn't very British that is also in the music, which is this sort of heartland rock sound that, you know, obviously Bruce and Jay Giles Band. And, you know, we know that music. Where is the roots of that? And how does that fit into the British sound?
Well, we're way different than the Springsteen and that, because we're from the South. You know, we grew up in Florida. There's a lot of great blues and country music on the radio when we were growing up. You know, like Howlin' Wolf, Muddy Waters, John Lee Hooker, Bo Diddley, and of course Elvis and Johnny Cash. All that kind of stuff was Southern influenced, and there's a cadence in the way Southerners talk and a little bit of the accent and the delivery that is kind of special to us, I think, because we grew up around that. And then you put that with the British thing and it kind of mixes together. That's kind of what we were.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I suppose Heartland, a lot of that is really just, it's about the lyrics too. It's about storytelling of working class people, isn't it?
Yeah.
Right. It's the personality of where the singer's coming from and the delivery. You know, if you deliver it with a slang and it has a thing on it, you know, that whatever that guy is, you get inside him, and a lot of them are, you know, Southern influence, because that's the people we grew up around.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
This episode of Rock on Tours is sponsored by AG1, the daily nutrition supplement.
AG1 is a comprehensive and convenient blend of over 70 vitamins, minerals, and other vital ingredients like gut-friendly bacteria, antioxidants, and much more.
Just one scoop of AG1 daily has all the nutrients you need to support your mental performance, energy levels, heart health, and immune system.
To be honest, it's pretty vital stuff for us, because when you've got a life on the road and you're short of time, or you're too busy to plan and prepare healthy meals, you're getting your podcast together, you're being shouted at, and it's just a nightmare, AG1 gives me all the good stuff and helps keep my energy levels where I need, ready for showtime or doing the podcast, and with a nice vanilla taste.
It keeps me focused, feeling good, feeling healthy with its daily dose of vitamin C and zinc. And it's so easy to use. Just one scoop a day gives me over 70 carefully selected ingredients. Simple.
Trusted by Olympians, F1 drivers and the Rock on Tours. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and a free 1-year supply of vitamin D and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription.
Go to drinkag1.com/rockontours. That's drinkag1.com/rockontours. Check it out.
It was obviously totally full on with the Heartbreakers for quite a while. When did you start looking left or right to kind of work with other people? Or did that start with Stevie?
Well, it's like Sammy Cahn's great quote, like, what comes first, the words or the music? It's the phone call, you know? I feel like I'm one of the most blessed people on earth, really. I've just had things come my way, you know. A lot of the people that I grew up worshiping musically, I've actually met them and played with them, and they told me they liked me, which is just mind-blowing. Yeah, yeah. You know? Yeah. So I've been very fortunate that way, and I did not go out and try to establish a solo career or seek out Johnny Cash or Roy Orbison. They just seemed to show up at my house.
Or Bob Dylan, Stevie Nicks.
Destiny, I guess.
I suppose one of the people that helped to change things for you was Jimmy Iovine, though, wasn't he? Because I think going into that album that particular time and working with Jimmy, you know, it'd come off, you know, such great records like, you know, the Patti Smith record at Easter, you know, and giving you a sound, a production that was so clean and powerful.
Yeah.
How was it, your relationship with him?
Oh, I had and still have a great relationship with Jimmy. He's a beautiful person. We sought him out because we liked the sound of the Patti Smith record. We'd heard that. We thought, you know, we could get a better sound than our band, you know, a little punchier, a little more clear, like you said. So if we get him, he can make us sound better, you know. He brought his engineer, Shelly Yakas, along. And I tell you what, though, it was hard getting those sounds. You know, I don't make records like that anymore, but we got really meticulous with every little nuance of this part of the snare drum's tuned to C sharp, the bottom head's tuned to E flat, and you put the mic over.
Oh my God.
I mean, it kind of drove me nuts really making those records with him because they were so scientific. And sometimes it was hard to find the fun in the middle of all that process.
More craft than art.
That sound, it worked for that time. I don't think I'd want to make records that sound like that now because I've moved on to a different vibe. But it was a good time to make those records, and he was perfect for that job.
Yeah, it was the million-dollar snare drum sound, wasn't it?
It was all about the snare.
Yeah, days and days spent on a snare. Which you kept basically until Jeff Lynne came into the picture. And then Jeff kind of redefined drums, didn't he? That big, boxy, roomy sound.
Yeah, Jeff is a whole different type producer, but he, in a lot of ways, he's my favorite producer you've ever worked with. He makes it fun and it's fast. He gets he gets shit done really quick. Mm-hmm. He knows what he's doing. He's got so many ideas. He's a musician. See, Jimmy Iovine is not a musician. He's coming from a producer point of view who doesn't play. Jeff can play any instrument you put in his hands. He can sing. He can write. He can get sounds. You know, he was just a joy to work with. And completely different. He doesn't like to have the whole band playing at once. He doesn't work that way.
Oh, that's interesting.
Which works really good for his approach in certain songs, like I Won't Back Down and Free Falling. His production on those songs made the songs great. Yeah. You know?
I've got to say, Free Falling is another one. It's another one of my all-time. I had a girlfriend who lived in Encino when that came out. And that.
Okay, we don't want to go there, right?
It was about her, yeah.
Yeah, but... Mike, the other thing that Jeff's famous for is he hates reverb, right?
Yeah, he took our reverbs away.
Did he? Sir, he took our reverbs away.
He did. But he would get a sound in the room on the bike, which had a little room to it. And it forced Tom to really, you know, hear every nuance of his voice and sing that way, you know, kind of bare and naked. And not lean back in the reverb. So in a lot of ways, it was good for us.
Yeah. Well, I just a little bit interested. And I think after talking to you, even for this short amount of time, I can see what a generous guy you are. But I'm just interested to know how it felt to have, you know, you had a writing relationship with Tom and you were the guitar player, right hand man. And then Jeff comes in. He's another guitar player and he's writing a lot with Tom. Did that feel like another woman, if you know what I'm saying, Mike?
I know what you're saying. I don't ever remember feeling any kind of jealousy. I was just happy to be in the room, you know, and the stuff was coming in so good. I mean, I did end up getting some co-writes with them. But no, you know, it's like a breath of fresh air for both of us, you know, bring in some new energy. And, you know, it's interesting with Jeff, we would start a track in the afternoon and by 6 p.m. the record was done. All background vocal, solo, harmonies,
wow.
The vocal, he just gets it done. But I found out early in the process that you better have some ideas in your pocket, because we cut a track one day and we needed to put a guitar on it. So next day we came in and he said, so, well, Mike, have you got any ideas? And I'm used to just, we'll run the tape and I'll fall into something. Said, no, not off the top. He said, well, I do. And he'd been up all night working the hard part, right? And it was great.
Ooh.
So I learned real fast that if I want to get a record, I better just say, yeah, I got something right here. You know? From then on, I had something ready to go. You know, I did my homework.
And that heat is horrible, isn't it? I can imagine what that feels like when all the eyes are on you. I mean, it's a bit like poor George Harrison in the Get Back film, when you can see that Paul isn't happy with what he's playing, but he's just really under pressure because the cameras are on him.
Yeah. George is a wonderful guy. You know, on the song Handle With Care,
oh, yeah.
George liked me for some reason. He just really liked me, and he was real kind to me. They called me down to the session. They hadn't put the slide guitar on Handle With Care yet. And they wanted me to play on it, you know, because they were just generous that way. So I went down there and, you know, there's Jeff Lynne and George Harrison, who I didn't know that well yet. And I'm pretty intimidated. And I got my amp guitar and they ran the track and I was playing, but I was kind of like a little bit frozen up because that's the Beatles sitting there, you know?
Yeah.
And so finally, Jeff said, no, that's pretty good what you did. And I said, no, it's not right. I said, what I hear on here is George playing the slide because it's
George Harrison.
If he plays it, it'd be better than what I'm doing. So he took my guitar with my sound and played that beautiful slide solo. But that's an instance where I was just, you know, intimidated by the presence in the room. It does happen sometimes, you know.
I think you as a guitar player, it's very interesting guy, because I think, you know, we can all see as a guitarist, we can all see how amazing what your chops are and what you do, but you serve the song. It's never like, well, hang on, here's my spotlight. I've always felt that what you do is about, what's the melody we need for this intro? What does this song need to feel in the instrumental section?
Right. Some of that's luck and it's just instincts. You know, I listen really close to the vocal when I'm trying to think of a guitar line. I'll sit back while they're working on the vocal or getting the sound and they keep playing the track. I'll sit in the back of the room and just listen, you know, and I'll listen to the melody of the vocal. And then I'll start to sing in my head, well, the guitar played that melody. Where would I play it on the neck? And how could I phrase it to sound like the voice? And that's how I approach it. And I think that's how a lot of those songs in the 60s were done too. And if you're creating a guitar part to a track and over chords that's similar to the vocal line, which works, it's going to work, you know. Get too far away from that spirit or that melody, you might take the song into the wrong direction. So that's all I could say about it, is you just wait for it to come to you. And sometimes it's just when you're not thinking about it, you're just noodling along and then you go, oh, that was good. You know, what was that? Play that back to me. Let me learn that and make that a bit for the song. So you're listening and editing yourself and just, you know, trying not to analyze too much and let it come through you and stay in the voice. Be like another guy. Like if you were the other singer singing with this guy, what notes would you play? What would you sing? And that's what I tend to do. And that seems to help me. And if I get stuck and I can't think of anything, I go to Chuck Berry.
I say that's sound advice for any. That's very good advice. With the Heartbreakers, you basically had two personnel changes over a period of God knows how many years, you know, one of which was major, which, you know, when Steve Ferroni turned up. Also, I heard a story. This is a real bit of trivia, but I remember some American musician years ago telling me this story about your original bass player, Ron Blair. When he left the band or whatever happened, and he went and started a bikini shop. But apparently that was actually always the plan. He was actually only in the band in order to get himself a bikini shop.
It's not simple.
No. Okay.
It's not that simple.
Idea, though.
Yeah.
I mean, but Steve Ferroni, obviously, you met on the Wildflowers album, and you know him, don't you, guys?
I'm very honoured to say that Steve Ferroni and myself are the rhythm section on Earth Song by Michael Jackson.
Well done. I sat in for a George Harrison concert, and Steve was the drummer on that date at Albert Hall, and we immediately became friends. So I suggested him to Tom when we were looking for someone to do that record. And he came in and kind of blew away all the competition pretty quick.
Yeah. Well, what is that song we were talking about? What is that song on Wildflowers? I think it might have been the first thing he played. Gary, can you remember?
It's you don't know how it feels.
It's just this beautiful. It's like a Bonham thing and it just doesn't move. And it's so completely different to anything we've heard, you know, from you guys before. And it's fantastic.
The very first day on was a song called Hard on Me. And I think the second song he played on was You Wreck Me. And then later on, we were trying to, quote unquote, make a hit. We did You Don't Know How It Feels. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's that beat is very Bonham, very simple. Mm-hmm. The thing with Steve is he comes from a jazz background and he had to really dumb it down to play with us. You know, don't play any fills.
Well, that average white band. I mean, come on.
We didn't want that. We said, Steve, like, you got a great time, but we don't want any of those fiddly bits. You know, keep it simple. Hold a beat down for us. You know, don't play maybe one fill in the whole song and we'll be happy.
But how does the solo stuff work with Tom? Because it was basically the Heartbreakers as the backing band minus the drummer, I think, wasn't it? And did it feel like at any point in that album with Rick Rubin that you guys made, did it feel like, you know, maybe we should just be calling this Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers? Was it a different room to be in?
I don't remember that ever being a discussion. I remember we wanted to work with Rick Rubin. We didn't even know if it was a solo record or a band record. We were at that point, we were at a point where the band was a little burned out on each other. And Tom got some songs. We came in with Rick, brought some players in. And then we looked up, you know, a few weeks later and there was five songs there and the Heartbreakers weren't on them. So we said, well, I guess this was going to be a solo record, you know. So it was organically just turned into that. There was no great plan or anything.
How did you find the switch to Rick? Because Rick really is about stone cold, in your face, kind of stripped down authenticity in the music, isn't he? That seems to be his MO.
Yeah. And also, you know, getting a band playing at the same time, which we did not do with Jeff. Mm-mm. And I love doing records the way Jeff does them too. But after a couple of those, we thought it'd be nice, you know, maybe to go back and cut some tracks with chemistry and interplay and live. And we thought Rick would be good for that, and he was. And so all the tracks on that record are live performances with the players, not built up one piece at a time.
And was that at your house?
A lot of it was recorded here. Yeah, I have a state-of-the-art studio where I've done the Dirty Knobs records. And it's a Neve console. It's just great. We've done some Heartbreaker stuff here, a lot of overdubs, a little bit of tracking over the years. It's not the biggest studio to have eight guys hanging around, but if it's only four, it works out fine.
You had the lovely Michael Kamen on that album too, who Guy and I both
was my neighbor. And Steve McLaughlin, we saw, his fabulous engineer.
But doing all the orchestration, Michael.
Yeah. Michael Kamen was a genius. Yeah. Wonderful.
Amazing man. One of the most charismatic men to ever live, I say.
We had Dave Stewart on the show as well. He was talking about writing that song with Tom. You know, these English guys coming in and sort of like, they that never bothers you, Mike.
No, I was much inspired by them. You know, we're going to like them right off the bat, you know, because they're English and we're not. But I like working with Dave Stewart too. And a lot of the Dave Stewart stuff ended up being with full band, overdubbed here and there. Sometimes we tracked a couple of songs I think he built up from a drum machine. But it's just whatever's happening that day, you know. But I was never, you know, challenged or intimidated by it. I just wanted to be part of the team and learn and contribute.
How was it writing with Dylan? I mean, I can't imagine how anyone could sit in a room with Bob Dylan and try and share a song with him.
I didn't. I had you talk about this song, Jamming Me.
Yeah.
Me and Tom and Bob. I never sat with Bob and wrote a song. I gave it to Tom. And he went over to Bob's hotel one day and they had the newspaper out and he played him my track and they sang stuff out of the newspaper over the track, gave him some lyrics. So I never actually sat with Bob and wrote that song.
When you toured with him, the Heartbreakers were the band, right? You were his band. Does that mean you were doing both sets? You were playing a full Heartbreaker set and then being his band?
Well, it was a half Heartbreaker set. We do...
It'd be exhausting.
You know, we were young. Yeah. We loved it. We were playing with Bob Dylan. We were excited.
You were the band.
But the Heartbreakers would do a 30-minute set, and we'd take a little break and go out with Bob for about an hour. And then we would leave, and he would do his solo thing, which was always just brilliant. And then we would come back on and end the show with him.
All right. And someone shouts Judas from the audience.
But playing with Bob was... a thrill.
Live, he's famously obtuse, isn't he? And sort of trips up the band and stuff. Or was it not like that with you?
Well, not to hear him say it, no. He's in the moment. You know, it's almost a little bit like a beautiful anarchy in a way, because during the show, if we're coming up to the song on the set list, he may not want to do that song. Or he might want to do it, but he might decide he feels it as a waltz tonight. And so he'll start playing and the band will it's not used to go like that. Now it goes like this. And we got pretty good at it. It was really a challenge for us, but it was so different than the Heartbreakers, who were like, you know, you play by the script and you build a set and you get an arc and, you know, and please the audience. And Bob was just kind of like, hey, I'm going to do what I want to do, and I hope you like it.
Well, I don't know about I hope you like it. Even. I mean, I've seen Dylan shows where I couldn't tell what song he was singing until he sang the title.
Yeah. That's au contraire, Mr. Dylan. Yeah.
But I guess, Mike, if in doubt, just play Chuck Berry, right?
He's a beautiful artist and probably my favorite writer. If I had to pick one, it would be him.
Well, you can hear it. And I was talking about, you know, where that American Heartland stuff came from. And that, you know, we've been talking about inspiration and influences. And of course, in Tom's voice, especially, you can hear Dylan, can't you? It's he started it all.
Yeah.
I saw that last London show you did at Hyde Park, which was absolutely fantastic.
Thank you.
And I don't know how much you want to say about that time when, you know, you got the call about Tom and how the band and the Heartbreakers dealt with all of that.
Well, it's how do you deal with the death in the family? I'm still grieving, and I'll probably always grieve, but I'm getting past the hollow, empty grieving into more of a grateful type of grieving where I hear the songs and I think of him and I have dreams about him sometimes that are beautiful. I have great memories and I hold on to those. And I always kind of feel like he's sitting next to me in a way because we were so close. And if I'm doing anything and I don't know why I should do it. It's almost like I go, hey, what would you do? And he kind of leads me, you know. It sounds kind of corny, but we were really close, you know, and, you know, it was a mishap that he should still be here, but it was just an accidental thing that happened. And it kind of shook our world quite strongly, you know. And I don't think you ever get over something like that, you know, but you have to carry on.
Yeah.
And keep making music, you know.
Yeah. I mean, especially, you know, someone who's so full of creative juice and life, for them to be taken away so soon is, you know, that's so shocking.
Aside from being in a band, we were brothers, you know, we were really close friends. And I think what I missed the most, I missed the music, but I also just missed the phone calls. You know, we just talk on the phone. And he was so funny and a great conversationalist and very smart. And I really missed those conversations.
Yeah. You know? So, yeah, because some of his writing, I was with a girl on LSD. I mean, that's almost like the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band or something. It's so funny.
Well, that's like, you know, he could make that shit up on the spot.
Yeah.
That song was just on the spot. You know, he started playing, he started making up the words, putting the rhyme together as he went. And I would see him do that. It would just amaze me, you know, how he would just make up lyrics right on the spot and they would rhyme and make sense. And, you know, he was a great talent. Thank God we got to make all that music. That music will live forever, you know.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And how's Benmont Tench? What's he up to now?
He has a solo record about to come out on Dark Horse Records. I just heard he signed with them. And he's got a new child and a little daughter, and he loves her. He's been staying home with her a lot. I saw him recently. We did a little interview together, and he's happy.
Aww.
What I loved about your sound, and you can hear it all the way through the Heartbreakers, is that the voicing between your guitar and Benmont's Hammond piano, especially the Hammond, I think, has this incredible chorus cadence that goes on. It's really symbiotic.
Yeah, ain't we something?
You are. I mean, is that something you sat and work out all the time? Is he really good at just tuning in?
It's something we instinctively knew how to stay out of each other's way. And if he's playing a certain thing, I know, well, if I play up here, it'll fit with that, or vice versa. But we never talked about it. It's just, that's the sound we make together, you know?
Okay. Fleetwood Mac.
Yeah. I saw that tour too. How did that feel? You being on stage, taking over.
But mind you, you're with another amazing songwriter there, Neil Finn.
Yeah,
come on. He's, you know.
Come on, exactly. I mean, like I said before, things just come my way.
Yeah, you're doing all the Lindsey Buckingham parts. I mean, it was pretty tough.
It was a challenge, but it was good for me, you know, because I'm not used to doing that. I'm used to playing my own parts. But I agreed to do the gig, and I love those records. I have nothing but the greatest respect for Lindsey. My job was to try to make those songs sound as close to the record as I could. So I had to get in there and do a little wood shedding, you know, and it's a muscle that I don't normally use, but I enjoyed it, you know, and his parts are so good. I tried to learn them the best I could and bring them to the band so that when people heard the song, they would recognize it, you know, and that was my job.
I heard you say in an interview how, and I know this exactly, that thing of when someone's done a part, which to them is just a throwaway thing that they've come up with, those are actually the hardest things to learn.
Exactly, like on Boys of Summer. You know, when I did all those little guitar bits, da-da-da, da-da-da, all that stuff, and it was one pass off the top of my head. And then we had to go in and make the record. I had to go back and learn those.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I didn't know what I did. So it's hard. It was the same thing with Lindsey's stuff. Or even if the Heartbreakers would do a cover, like an old Bo Diddley song or whatever it might be, or the Zombies, I try to get into that guitar player's head and try to learn what did he do and how did he do it. So with Fleetwood Mac, it was the same sort of thing. I would just listen really closely and study them the best I could and play them well. And the tour was really good. It was sold out everywhere. Went around the world, had a blast, a lot of days off for tooling around, and great people. The rhythm section, I mean, every day, they're standing behind me. So I was just like a kid in a candy store.
We had Mick on the show. He's such a great guy.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
He was very emotional at the end of our chat. He was saying, I just want to get back up on stage one more time with the band, you know.
I know. I think John would probably be just happy just to keep staying on a sailboat, you know. And Chris likes, you know, taking care of her garden in England. And Stevie wants to do some of her own touring. So Mick might have to wait for that.
Are you still working with Stevie?
I am not working with her at the moment, but I'm in touch with her. We're really dear friends, and she's doing well. We check in on each other from time to time.
She did a great single with Dave Stewart, actually, just a last single that came out a couple of years ago.
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah, Stevie's wonderful. I love her.
So are you coming to the UK with the Dirty Knobs?
I hope so. It won't be this year. We're starting from the bottom, guys. We're starting from the bottom. We're going to work our way back up through the ranks. And hopefully we'll get successful enough that we can afford to book a tour over there. I'd love to come back with this band and play all over Europe, but certainly England and Ireland. I love it there. So,
yeah, well, you know, so we found you first. I'm sure we'd love to find you all over again.
This year's a test to see how we do here. And it looks like we're going to do pretty well. So if things pick up a little bit, we can get the economics together. We'll be over there. I want to go for sure.
Yeah. Guy and I play with Nick Mason from Pink Floyd. We play in his band. Oh. And we have been putting off our tours for the last, I think, nearly 3 years now, guys. Isn't it? Like 2.5 years.
It's going to be 2 years since our first cancellation. We had to cancel the American tour when all the gear was already on a ship. God.
It's been hard on everybody, but yeah. I think I'm starting to see, I don't want to jinx it, knock on wood. I think I see a little light at the end of this tunnel.
Yeah, no, I think
yeah.
so.
Yeah. Mike, it's been such a pleasure to have you on our show.
And you, thank you. Very insightful questions. And
we wish you luck with the new album.
Oh, thank you. I think we can use it.
Especially if Ian Hunter's on it.
It's great. It sounds great.
It's going to be fun live. Yeah, I think people will be surprised. It's a great little band. We rock.
All right, man.
You do.
Thank you so much, Mike. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very, very much, Mike. Really great to have you.
He takes it all in his stride. Bob Dylan.
He does take it all in his stride while smoking a pipe,
which was wonderfully Spinal Tap. I loved it. It was a really ornate pipe, for those of you who couldn't see it.
But I like that thing of just feeling just lucky, you know, that it all just kind of seemed to came his way. But it came his way for a reason.
Yeah, that's right, of course. And, you know, he's the sort of go-to guy for so many people who want that American sound. I mean, he talks about it being British, but that sound, the thing he does.
But it's funny, but there's, in a way that, you know, that original British sound came from guys trying to do an American thing, and then it went back to America, and then you had these Americans trying to sell it back to the British, this British thing. And now you have guys who have sort of, it's now five generations removed, where he now is this American guy who has that American version of a British thing, which everyone...
Yeah, there'll be a map of that comment we'll put on social media at some point. There's a few little cross-reference ones you can go back on our pod. You can go back and listen to the Dave Stewart one. He talks about Tom Petty a lot there. And the Justin Hayward podcast, where he talks about Denny Cordell.
Yeah, and of course, Shell Tell Me, but just for the reference. But also, if you just look at his Wikipedia page, there's just a ton of stuff we couldn't get to. There are so many collaborations. Yeah. It's incredible.
Thank you for listening, and we'll be back next week with another giant.
Yes, they'll be at least 11 feet tall.
Until then, it's good night from me.
And good night from him.
I want you to know I heard every word.
Oh, no, he heard that. You heard that.
I thought I signed off and I heard you guys talking. So I'm like, what are these guys going to say about me? Personally, you were kind.
Yes.
We're all good. Okay, bye.
Well, we're all going now as well. So we're going to sign off here.
Yeah,
so,
we're all off, mate. We're all off.
We're going to go. Speak later. Bye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.